Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand.
I am a programmer. I can make something different show on the screen than what is counted in the results in the background.
There was nothing wrong with the recount in Florida. There was confusion. There was some counties that may have different requirements. But the fact is, that would have been a far better alternative than a Supreme Court who had no business, no legal business whatsoever. That election was stolen by the Supreme Court. Okay?
When they say, well, you're just crazy conspiracy people, you know, it's crazy to think that we should trust the people who continually lie to us.
A forum in Oak Park exposes the hazards of e-voting, coming soon to a polling place near you. But first, a few short indie media stories. Families of the wrongly convicted sponsored a candlelight vigil last Thursday in memory of its founder, May Molina Ortiz, who died in police custody 1 year ago. The vigil was held outside Belmont and Western, near the station where she died. Molina Ortiz and her son Michael Ortiz were arrested for drug possession during a police raid shortly before her death. Police say she died of a heroin overdose, but the family says that the 55-year-old wheelchair-bound grandmother died of medical neglect after their attempts to deliver her prescription medications for various health problems, including diabetes and high blood pressure, were denied. Michael Ortiz, who spent over 10 days in custody, was finally released for lack of evidence. Two lawsuits filed over the incident are still pending, and Chicago police say an ongoing investigation won't be completed until the end of June.
Our courts, our rights, don't give up the fight! Our courts, our rights, don't give up the fight!
About 1,000 demonstrators gathered in Federal Plaza on April 27th to protest right-wing appointments to federal judgeships. The demonstration was just one of over 100 do-it-yourself protests scheduled that day across the country, sponsored by MoveOn.org, and carried out by volunteers at each different location. Fox News was the only mainstream media to cover the event. It is speculated that they were attracted by demonstrators' signs that read, "Right-wing judges only," signs the demonstrators had planned to post outside the federal court in Chicago. Catherine Caparuso led the Chicago protest.
This rally is about fairness. This is about justice. This is about equality. It's about freedom. And it's about protecting our rights. And it's about preventing the Republicans from doing away with a 200-year-old rule so that they can pack the federal courts with right-wing justices. And I happen to be an attorney, and I practice in the federal court, which is right over there. And that's what those signs are for, those right-wing judges only that keep out. We would be in front of there, except they don't really like it when you stand in front of the courthouse. But I know from firsthand experience exactly how important it is to have fair and impartial judges in positions that they hold for their entire lives. Senator Frist says that we're here because we're trying to prevent the confirmation of people of faith. Is that true?
No.
We're here because we want judges that make decisions based on a fair reading of the law, not their own personal biases. We want judges that won't give corporate interests free rein to abuse their workers and pollute the earth. We want judges who will respect the separation of church and state. And we want judges that will respect the right to privacy and liberty and equality.
Last week, a compromise between Democrats and Republicans allowed the first of 10 controversial judicial nominations to be approved. The Doctor, the Depleted Uranium, and the Dying Children was a featured documentary at the recent Citizens Epidemiology Conference at Northwestern University.
Professor Siegfried Horst Günther is on his way to Iraq. The 79-year-old is escorted by Ted Wayman, deputy director of the Uranium Medical Research Center in Toronto, Canada. Two men looking for evidence that depleted uranium, DU ammunition, was used by the ton in the recent Iraq war. They're convinced it's responsible for Gulf War syndrome, which has now undermined the health of hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilians. Each man has his own reasons for making this trip. Baghdad Gate Number 6. In 2003, tanks clashed here in heavy fighting. Not far from the old city gate, Ted Wayman and Dr. Shakely planned to check the soil for traces of uranium. Only meters away, a refreshment stand.
You want to find something?
Yeah, we have a radiation count at this location, which was a site of a tank battle. The tank has been pulled out of here. Of about 100 times to 150 times above normal, which is the highest level we've found so far.
Where was that?
You know, at that level, it's definitely prohibited. If the area have such a level, it's prohibited from human being, existence.
Depleted uranium, or DU, was just one of the topics covered at the conference. We will have more on the subject on our June program. Until then, for more information, go to traprockpeace.org. Unembedded independent reporter Dar Jamal spoke about conditions in Iraq at the Peace Museum last month. He said child malnutrition rates have almost doubled since the occupation, and that reports placing the number of Iraqi casualties at about 100,000 are too low.
I'm often asked, well, how many people have been killed in Iraq? Because if we look at Iraq body count, we see 16,000 or so. And then if Landsat reported 100,000. And I think both are incorrect, because if we look at the Landsat survey of 98,000, it's too low for a number of reasons. One, they didn't include areas of Iraq where there have been major combat operations. It doesn't include either Siege of Fallujah. It doesn't include Najaf. So there's several thousand people right there, at least 4,000. B, it's out of date. C, it's a study whose baseline, that they're comparing what's happening in the occupation now to a baseline which was the last 2 years of the sanctions. It was 2001 to 2003. So the sanctions, again, a situation where, not even talking about adults, but just in children, there were over 500,000 children died, and that's the baseline for this Landsat survey of 100,000 deaths. So it could be easily argued that there could very well be over 200,000 deaths in Iraq so far.
Jamal also found problems with the reconstruction of Iraq.
Another aspect of the reconstruction that I've focused pretty intensively on is the water infrastructure. I did a report for Public Citizen about a year ago. They're a watchdog group out of D.C. They mentioned three places that I focused in on in their contract of water treatment plants that they were going to rehabilitate. And these were in Najaf, Hilla, and Diwaniyah, three cities just south of Baghdad. And I went there, and the best case scenario, in all of them I spoke with either the head engineer or assistant engineer at each plant. In the best case scenario, one of them said, well, some folks from Bechtel came by, but they just replaced the sand filters here, which didn't in effect produce any more potable water. The other two places, they basically said Bechtel do. One of those was in Najaf. And like most villages in Iraq, even up in the north, it gets between 1 and 3 hours of electricity per day now, far below pre-war levels. And so here, when that electricity's on, water flows up through that pipe, and of course then it fills the hole with water, and that's one of the village's primary drinking sources. So we have rampant nausea, diarrhea, kidney stones, cholera, other waterborne diseases, and then these folks get to go back into the hospitals. Bechtel has, of course, been paid out in full for their initial contract of $680 million, and they've been awarded contracts totaling $3.8 billion.
You can go to DarJamalIraq.com for more information. That's spelled D-A-H-R-J-A-M-A-I-L iraq.com. The clip of Jamal's talk comes courtesy of Mitchell Stupinczyk. For breaking indie media headlines in Chicago and around the world, visit our internet address at www.chicago.indymedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches. The next time you go to the polls, you may be voting by computer. E-voting is on its way to Cook County in Chicago. It's likely that at least one e-voting machine, or DRE, direct recording electronic machine, will appear in each precinct by 2006. The move is mandated by HAVA, the Help America Vote Act of 2002, that requires states to provide voting equipment that allows disabled voters to cast their ballots without assistance. But some question the reliability of these machines. Invisible Ballots, a documentary film about electronic voting fraud, opened a forum called Your Ballot, Your Future at Oak Park Public Library on April 30th.
It has been said that those who vote are not as important as those who count the votes. That's the theme of the program you're about to see. Most people today would be outraged at any effort to take away their right to vote. Yet, under the guise of voting reform, that is exactly what may well happen in the days ahead.
Accidents happen in elections all the time.
The real danger, in my opinion, as a computer technician, is the simple, everyday glitches, problems, bugs that exist in computer software, which means you can get the wrong results despite your best intentions. And the problem is you could get the wrong results and not even realize your results are wrong.
A startling document revealed in the film reaches back to the 2000 presidential elections when e-voting was already in use in Florida.
I think the one that concerns me the most is probably the memos that come from Talbot Iredale for a couple reasons, because this guy's the senior vice president of research and development. He was also hired. He was one of the original hires back in 1988, and so he knows everything about every system, and he's in charge of the programmers. His memo on what happened, what really happened in Volusia County in the presidential election 2000, was a blockbuster. Understand that this is right in the middle of the election between Al Gore and George Bush.
This is, of course, when we have all the problems with Al Gore. For some odd reason, the machines reported him as having negative 16,022 votes. They have little cards that the data is recorded on when people cast their votes, and those cards are then taken to a central machine, which then tallies up the total votes on them and records them. Diebel has several memos discussing this. They talk about that there was evidence that a second card was used, which would have been an unauthorized memory card.
Talbot Iredale's memo says, actually, it was a replacement set of votes. The original set of votes was on card number 0. Then a replacement set on card number 3 was put in 1 hour later. All of the races were correct except the presidential race. And in the presidential race, it took 16,022 votes away from Gore.
But no one knows where this second card came from, and no one knows where it went after the election. No one has ever been able to come up with a satisfactory explanation or to produce the card in question.
They called the election specifically because of the 16,000 votes in Volusia County. The fact that it was an error did come out, and they did correct it. But they didn't correct it until they had called the election for Bush erroneously, and Al Gore had conceded erroneously to Bush.
The Oak Park Coalition for Truth and Justice, which sponsored the showing of this documentary, welcomed Cook County Clerk David Orr into the discussion. Orr, a one-time Chicago alderman and vice mayor, has been in Chicago politics for 25 years. As clerk, he oversees the third largest elections operation in the country.
The national debate over election security is really quite different now than it was a few years ago, when some election officials were arguing that electronic voting, that is, were simply infallible. There couldn't be any problems. And the clamor for paper trail and other security issues has made significant inroads, including in Illinois now, because Illinois was the first large state to actually require a voter-verified paper audit trail. And I'm proud of the work that this office did and others, in fact, in passing that. And actually, Speaker Madigan was crucial in passing it. So anyway, fortunately, we do have that in the law, and hopefully that will help in terms of our confidence. Now, other states since that time have been adopting requirements for the paper trail. Remember Nevada, I can't remember if it was in the videotape, but Nevada not only has required the law, but has actually seen it in working. So it's last November. They voted with a paper trail box. We'll probably talk about that. Actually, I think, Peter, weren't you there? Yes. Peter McClendon from our staff was out in Vegas watching how people did it. Let me try and describe it quickly. In other words, let's assume that you're standing at one of these electronic devices, okay, with a big screen there. Okay, basically what they're doing is they're putting a box, okay, that can attach onto the side of each of those voting machines that runs a tape. And so when you're done voting and you get to the summary page, and the summary page tells you if you've overvoted, well, you're actually on a DRE, you can't overvote, but it tells you what races you might have skipped. And so if you want to correct those, then it says, do you want to verify your ballot or something like that? And you push it, and then you'll finally see a screen again. And then what they'll do is this tape will run. I think some machines it's on your left, some it's on your right. So it's like a tape, grocery store tape. It will run with the candidates you voted for. And for the people that want to take the time, they basically look, you know, Bush, wait a second. You know, but you basically can compare that. And then after that, you go through that process, which will be a little lengthier in places like Cook because of our long ballot. Okay, then you have a choice, accept or correct. Okay, because if you find something that, wait a second, I didn't mean to vote for that, I didn't vote for that, you can correct it, and then that tape will be voided, and another tape will run. All these tapes, by the way, fall into a secure ballot box for recounts or whatever. And if you're satisfied that tape reflects what you did and the machine properly reflected what you did, you push accept, and that will be, again, captured, and you are done. But that's basically what has been created so far. Also, I'm just going to say that California and Ohio are now requiring it. So an election machine, manufacturers have gotten a little better now because they're realizing some places are serious about it. When we had a demonstration that some of you might have come to about last October, the vendors didn't take it very seriously. They were hoping the law might go away. They were hoping that we were going to be very loose about it. Since that time, they've gotten more serious. But there's been definite improvements and some progress there, I want to make sure that you understand that the tide is also kind of going the other way as well. I'm a member of the EAC, which is the Election Assistance Commission, which is that new federal commission. I just came back from a meeting. Most of the people on this panel, there's only about 25 of us, most of the people do not buy the idea, the necessity of a VVPAT, voter verified paper audit trail. They don't buy it. They don't think it's necessary. They think there's all sorts of problems with it, that these boxes I described are going to have problems, that voters won't pay attention to it. There's an awful lot of people who are experts that don't buy it. Of course, most of the ones on the panel were Republican, but it's not particularly a Republican-Democratic issue, but to a large extent it still is.
You're listening to Cook County Clerk David Orr speaking at a forum at Oak Park Public Library in April. Orr, who was instrumental in creating the motor voter law in Illinois, has been working on several other measures to improve voter access. Among the bills that have passed and are expected to be signed by Governor Blagojevich are laws that will allow women who change their names at marriage to vote without re-registering under their new name, a law that allows voters to receive absentee ballots without having to give reasons for not voting on Election Day, and a law that allows absentee ballots to be counted if they are postmarked before Election Day and arrive up to 2 weeks after the elections. Orr would also like to see elections held on a weekend or holiday. He would like to see early voting up to 3 weeks before elections and same-day registration. Now we return to David Orr's remarks.
Now let me go back to HAVA for a moment because I want to get to particularly issues about the DREs, the direct recording electronic, the devices that a lot of discussion is taking place. Since HAVA was passed, jurisdictions around the country, of course, were faced with a challenge to replace certain technologies like punch card or lever, and I don't want to necessarily analyze how good or bad they are because a lot of myths are out there. But obviously the new technologies, or not say new, but the ones that are left for us to use are basically optical scan and DRE. And the DREs include screens where you touch, and there's other devices where you actually turn a wheel and punch. But the bottom line is they're all electronic in the sense that the votes themselves are recorded electronically. And as you also, I'm sure, know, that part of the driving force is that by the HAVA law, and a good thing, that we have to, by next year, have in all of our polling places a device at which the disabled can vote, particularly the blind. And that's where the DREs partly get their impetus, okay? And not just that. Remember, keep this in mind. Everything varies. We are very unique in a place like Cook because of our size and complexity. But so when I'm looking at new equipment, okay, for this county, I'm in a totally different position than if I was downstate. Because, number one, I have very complicated ballots, as you know. Number two, I have different languages. I have to fulfill English, Spanish, and Chinese, okay? And with punch cards, there's only so much room you can put things. With optical scan, there's only so much thing you can put things. With a DRE, you walk in, do you want to vote in English, Spanish, or Chinese? So the complexity of ballots, the visibility, the fact that you can't overvote. There are a lot of positive things about DREs, which is partly why they're getting a lot of attention. But the real impetus, like I say, was the disability requirement. But because of trying to meet that requirement, some people jumped out there and were working with vendors and trying to get machines without really thinking through the repercussions of not having an audible paper trail. So what steps can we take? Okay, can we do right now to make sure that our votes will count? One thing, see, some jurisdictions may get in trouble if they entrust their entire election voting process to the vendor. And unfortunately, many of them do. They're small. Remember, most of the places in Illinois have counties with less than 20,000 voters. Many of them have county clerk staff with three people, okay? And they don't just do elections. Okay, so they're going to rely much more on their vendor, okay, to set up everything. That's not the case in Cook. We have, for example, expert tech people, okay, who manage our data and audit our results. It's our election, not the vendor's. Elections break down into multitudes of tasks, managing the registration database, training judges, designing forms to make sure everything's done legally, informing voters about polling places, laying out ballot, programming machines, compiling data, auditing data. Likewise, results are not just a matter of the machines generating vote totals. There are a variety of procedures to make sure that it's secure. For example, there's redundancies in the process. On election night, for example, you can see that you get results very quickly. Usually you see that on the web. For those of you who are paying attention, we had a little problem this last local election. It crashed. Of course, we had all the results. We had 85% of the results in 45 minutes. And people could see them downtown, and we had hard copies. But if you were one of those people struggling on the web, you were out of luck for a while. But at the polling places, results come in twice. Okay, first they come in from the individual machines in the polling places that are sent downtown, and there's a tape of that, as you may know, that you can get. But then at the receiving stations, big counties, so we have 19 receiving stations where everything's taken. And there the results are sent by hardwire, okay, hardwired modems. And so if there's any discrepancies, we can get on that right away. Now, of course, these are still all unofficial votes. Following the election, we have recounts of randomly selected precincts, which is another fail-safe. But if we do adopt the DRE-type disabled units, we plan to go further. That is, we would not just have recounts of randomly selected precincts via machine. As you know, any DRE machine adopted by Illinois will be required to have the audit trail. We talked about that. But we want to go beyond that, okay, particularly because of the advice of many of you and discussions with people like Kevin. So understanding that you've got the results that electronically are recorded, then you've got the results of this tape that I mentioned, okay, by paper. But how do we make sure the paper is correct? So we are looking at a way to have randomly selection audits of paper, of these, of this paper, to compare with the count. Now, again, it's not going to be a great number of those. People have tried this in some cases. I think in Vegas they kind of gave up. But it's something we can do, and we can work with people like yourselves. You can all come in and can view all this process. Everything we do is public. Okay. When it comes to the 5% recount guaranteed by state law, you can see that. When it comes to the 1% that's going to be required now where there are DREs, we're talking about a step further. You finish that process. Let's say they all match up. Okay, but you say, wait a second. Sure, they match up because the machine said this and somehow someone corrupted this. Then you can actually count some of the paper, okay, to try, you know, randomly select it and then count some of that. This is one further step we believe will help to make sure that if there's any shenanigans, that they can be caught.
You're listening to Cook County Clerk David Orr speaking at the Oak Park Public Library on April 30th. Since Orr's speech at this voting forum, he has selected the DRE he hopes to buy for suburban Cook County, a touchscreen voting machine made by Sequoia. But Orr says not every voter will be using this device.
Because of money, we couldn't have a full DRE system if we wanted to. So those of you that are very nervous about DREs, you can rest assured, I don't think it's going to happen. Now, maybe in the future when things are a little tested more, we feel more comfortable. But there will still be a requirement that we have at least one DRE in every precinct. Of course, it will have the voter verifiable paper audit trail. But because of a number of shifts recently, we'll most likely have a dual system. And that dual system will probably be some kind of optic scan. Now, if you don't know, optical scan is it's just you know, take a piece of paper out, and usually they got the candidate's name and a little oval, and you take a pencil or a pen and just color it in, okay? And then that goes through a counter just like you vote with a punch card. When you finish with that ballot, you put it in what we call the PBC, the counter. It automatically tells you if there's been an overvote or an undervote. Securely then stays in the machine and is then automatically counted after the polls closed. Okay, so optical scan would mean the pluses for optical scan for voters. Okay, and probably almost everyone in Illinois will have optical scan. Almost everyone in Michigan, almost everyone in Wisconsin. Now, Georgia, of course, is all DREs. California will be mixed bag. Nevada is all DREs. Many places are mixed bag. New Mexico's a mixed bag. Arizona's a mixed bag. But so what that means is when you would go to vote, we'll probably have some sort of optical scan and then at least one DRE for the disabled or anybody who wants to use it. That's probably what we're going to end up with, but we're very late, and it makes it difficult for me because I am in charge of suburban Cook. I am not in charge of Chicago. I've never been in charge of Chicago, okay? And I think we, frankly, do a heck of a lot better job, but people think I'm in charge of Chicago. Even aldermen call me and ask me to fix things in Chicago that don't even realize I'm not in charge of Chicago. But the point is that if we can agree, the city and us, on a system, then it'll be the same for everybody in Cook County. If we can't, I don't know what happens, because I don't know that I would have the power to overrule. Okay, it's a very sensitive position to be in. I might say, this is the best system for us. And if the city says, that is the best system for us, I don't know if the politicians would say, thanks, Orr, but we'll tell you how to do it. We don't want to listen to what you think, okay? It'll be a pretty classic battle coming up fairly soon. All I can do is conclude that this is there's always a constant struggle, you know, and we all know that. And sometimes we make progress. Those people want to see the electorate expanded to make it easier, to make sure votes count. Sometimes they're in the ascendancy, sometimes they're not. A few years ago, we seemed like we were doing better, okay? Famous people who had never been listened to before, okay, fairly radical on terms of voter participation, they actually were listened to. There were changes made, motor voter, a number of other things. Okay, actually now things have been reversing. And the only reason we have the HAVA Act, which has some positive things, was because the Republicans were embarrassed twice. Not just in 2000, but also in 2002. And remember, before everyone jumps on the horse and gets too conspiratorial about the DREs and why and all that kind of stuff. The biggest single problem, there was nothing wrong with the recount in Florida. There was confusion. There was some counties that may have different requirements. But the fact is, that would have been a far better alternative than a Supreme Court who had no business, no legal business whatsoever. That election was stolen by the Supreme Court. Okay? But that is always ignored. It's almost never discussed in any of the issues. It's always those fools in Florida and all this kind of stuff. Okay? Anytime you have a recount, as they had in the state of Washington, there's nothing wrong with what happened in the state of Washington. Because when you take the time, you do go and check. And maybe this person voted an optical scan ballot. And maybe one vote would make the difference. But maybe this gentleman didn't realize he had to circle in the oval. So he circled the name. It's clear what his intent is. The machine didn't pick it up. That's optical scan.
It's just a system that can't do everything. So in Washington, they take the time and say, you know what? This guy circled the name. It's in the pile of throwouts. It shouldn't be thrown out. There's nothing wrong with taking the time to do it right, no matter what, you know, politicians and others scream about. So we know this stuff. And all I can say to you is that your vigilance is not only appreciated, but your vigilance is essential if, in fact, we're going to make it easier and more successful for people to vote. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
That was David Orr speaking at the forum Your Ballot, Your Future on April 30th at the Dole branch of the Oak Park Public Library. After Orr's speech, three panelists gave opening remarks before taking questions. First up was Carolyn Kay, an independent Chicago software designer and founder of MakeThemAccountable.com.
I am a programmer. I can make something different show on the screen than what is counted in the results in the background. I can make something show on a printed report next to the computer different from what is counted in the totals in the background. Okay, I can't tell you how I can do that, otherwise I'd have to train you as a programmer. So you're gonna have to trust me when I tell you that I can do that. And that is when I started to become concerned about these machines, was when I found out that they didn't have, most of them didn't have an audit trail that can be verified by the voter and that then goes into a box that can be later recounted depending on exit polls or just a random statistical check here and there, okay? Because that is the only way to verify whether these machines did what you thought you were telling them to do. And, you know, as they said in the DVD, we can't be sure that there's any shenanigans going on in the background, but we do know at least one instance of a case where somebody was asked to write code. We don't know if any of this code ever ended up in any machine anywhere in the United States, but we do know of an instance. I don't know if you guys have read Brad's blog. Mm-hmm. Brad Friedman has found a guy named Clint Curtis, who was a programmer for a company in Florida. That company was approached by a gentleman named Tom Feeney. And if you remember the 2000 election, you will remember that Tom Feeney at that time was Speaker of the House of Florida. And he was determined, he made it clear that he was going to have the electoral votes from Florida counted for George Bush regardless of what the court said, regardless of what the people said, regardless of what anybody said. Well, apparently he had approached this company, and the company brought in Clint Curtis to be the programmer. They said, write some code for us that will not show anywhere that anybody can determine, and that will flip the results. If we do special things on the screen, it will flip the results. Like if it was 60-40 one way, it goes 60-40 the other way. As I say, and Clint Curtis has been interviewed about this by John Conyers and his committees. He has passed a lie detector test on the information. As I say, we do not know whether this code was ever used anywhere, but we do know that the intent was at least there in some quarters. And I think most of you here don't think we can exactly trust Republicans when it comes to this kind of stuff. The other thing I wanted to clear up a little bit, because you may not be terribly familiar with how computer code gets written, and it may make it difficult for you to understand what some of the DVD was talking about and so on. When programmers write a program, it's in an English-like language that's called source code. If you're English, it's in English. If you're a Spanish programmer, it's probably in Spanish and so on. But it's more like a human language. It's very logical and step-by-step and all of that. But what happens next is that English-like code is translated into the kind of code that a machine can read. The instructions for the machine is take this number, add it to that number, put the result here, print that result on this report, clear that print line, go to the next record, and so on. So what Clint Curtis was charged to do was to write the code in such a way that it couldn't be detected. But of course, if you're sticking it somewhere into 10,000, 20,000 lines of code, it's possible that it might not ever be detected. Once it's translated into object code, the machine language readable, it can never be detected. There are untranslators that can, somewhat bring code back, but it's just really unlikely that that anybody would be able to figure that out. But as Clint Curtis, I was on a call, an interview call, where we asked him the question, and he agreed, and as a programmer, I agree as well, that one of the things that you could do was to put the source code in there with a little flip at the bottom that says, once this code is compiled, have the machine code go back and delete these lines from the source code so that the source code that then appears doesn't have that in it. Like magic, okay? So anyway, there are a number of ways that we need to verify elections. And is that my 2 minutes? Or maybe I'm over, okay? So.
That was independent Chicago software designer Carolyn Kay and founder of MakeThemAccountable.com. The next panelist was Ron Bayman, visiting senior research specialist at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at UIC. Bayman co-authored a study of exit poll data from the 2004 presidential elections.
What I have here is a study that was updated April 12th by a group of academics, including myself, outlining the problem with the exit polls for the U.S. 2004 presidential elections. And very quickly, just to highlight some of the key points here, there was a national exit poll, very large sample, very small margin of error. We took the margin of error published by the exit polling group, that is Edison Matofsky, the major exit poll that was done. The others also showed Kerry winning by significant margins. But this was the most extensive exit poll. Using their own margin of error that they published before the election, there was a 1 in 16.5 million chance that the exit poll could swing from 3% for Kerry to 2.7 for Bush. I mean, it was literally almost 100% reversal of the outcome. So that, on the face of it, just shows that the random probability explanation is impossible. Getting to some more detailed stuff, the major explanation has been the reluctant Bush responder to the exit polls. Edison Matofsky printed a report that this is a response to, basically, trying to explain how the exit polls could be so wrong, and they were more wrong this election than ever before. Though there have been discrepancies in past elections, their explanation was that the Republicans were reluctant to respond to the exit pollers. Well, they have tables in there. One of their tables shows exit poll response by partisanship of precinct. And as you can see in this graph on page 9, the more Republican the precinct, the higher the response rate, slightly higher. So that on the face of it, seems to contradict this idea that Republicans were less likely to respond. We have another hypothesis that in mixed company, Republicans were less likely to respond. That is, they're shy people. For whatever reason, you know, they want to get out of there quick. They don't want to. I've always said, look, there's challenges in these key states, and what we found is if you look at a state by state analysis, the exit polls were farthest off in the battleground states. In fact, out of 40-some states that we have data that Jonathan Simon captured screen snapshots on CNN late in the evening of the election, out of those 40-odd states, five states have discrepancies, and this is using all kinds of different ways of calculating the standard error. Five states have errors that are way outside a 5% confidence interval, or 10%, and four of those five are critical states. Three of them are the most critical, that is Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania. So again, you know, it just doesn't, and I have that date on the back of this handout. There's all these tables that show those calculations. In mixed company hypothesis breaks down when you look at another table, again presented by the Edison-Matofsky report. This is on page 10. You can see that if the mixed company hypothesis were true, you'd expect that where there's competitive precincts, there's precincts that are more or less balanced by partisanship of the vote, you'd expect the error to be the largest. That is, you know, the Kerry people there supposedly were not shy about going to the exit pollers. The Bush people were shy, so there'd be an overstatement of the Kerry vote, the largest within precinct error. To the contrary, you see that the biggest error is in the highly Bush precincts. The highest error of all 10% overstatement of the Kerry vote, I call it error, it's discrepancy, we don't know where it comes from the exit poll to the reported election outcome is in those precincts. We ran all kinds of, there's ways mathematically you can come up with these numbers, but you have to, if you do all the calculations in various ways, you have to come up with highly implausible response rates. That is, Democrats responding, you know, 20-30% more than Republicans, depending on the makeup of the exit poll. I mean, just, there's no assumption where you can posit a uniform bias, which is what Matofsky has been going around saying. There's some kind of uniform characteristic of Bush voters that makes them less likely to respond to exit pollers. It just does not show up in the data at all. And I've always said, you know, when you have challengers like in Ohio, you'd expect the Democrats to be shy about talking to people, not the Republicans. I mean, it just, the logic of this doesn't make a lot of sense. Also, in the Senate races, the same people responding to the exit polls for president and for Senate somehow managed to get exit polls for the Senate races that were quite close, much closer than the presidential race, which again makes no sense. Why would people somehow, you know, lie about their presidential choice on a form that nobody's seeing, basically? It's an anonymous form that you're filling out for an exit poller and not about their Senate race. On the machine types on page 18, you can see what we were talking about with David Orr. You can see that the WPE is within precinct error. This is page 18 on the bottom. The smallest error is paper ballots. The smallest discrepancy. That is, a minus means an overstatement, percentage overstatement of the Kerry vote. This is across all the precincts in all the states. You can see all the other errors. And here I wanna you know, make the point that it's not just DREs. It's central office counting equipment, optical scans. There were huge errors or discrepancies. Our conclusion has been that wherever you have some kind of a central office counting procedure, any kind of procedure that is computerized, that is software driven, and this all these big exit poll problems started happening in the 90s, there seemed to be errors. There seemed to be these discrepancies showing up. One thing Matofsky's been saying on page 17, if you look at, say, the Mark Blumenthal's website, Mystery Pollster, he's a Democratic pollster who's been kind of poo-pooing us as, you know, shoddy research or not supported in various ways. He makes the point that we claim that all these various factors that influence the discrepancy, we looked at each one individually, said they couldn't possibly explain these discrepancies. But if you have a multi-factor analysis combining a bunch of factors, you could possibly explain the discrepancy. The problem is, and I agree, The problem is Mitofsky, the pollsters, refused to release any of the raw data, refused to release any of the data upon which they're producing these tables. Without, they have a polling data, but it's weighted to match the actual results, so it's useless for this analysis. The problem is they, in their report, never correlate within precinct error to statewide exit poll discrepancy, and never correlate any of these factors to within precinct error. So is it the case that Ohio, Pennsylvania, they just happen to have younger pollsters? They happen to have standing far away, further away from the polling machine, from the actual precinct. The pollsters had to stand farther away. All these various factors, you know, more urban, more rural, so forth. All these factors apparently influence the degree of exit poll discrepancy. But you've got to show that there's some kind of correlation between that and what happened in the election. And they have not done that. It's their burden to show that. There's evidence that says no. I mean, there's lots of states where people were asked to stand far away from the precinct, and so they'd miss. They're trying to count one in five or whatever, and they miss a few here and there. They don't correlate with these states where the big discrepancy was. So that explanation you can't blame us for not doing that analysis. That's what they had to show, and they obviously did not show that. They did not present any of that in their report to relate these. They just talk about all these factors without relating them to how they relate to the exit poll. So if any of you have any questions, I'd be glad to talk about this more. Thank you very much.
That was Professor Ron Behman of UIC speaking about exit poll results from the 2004 presidential elections. The paper he mentioned can be found at uscountvotes.org. Behman says that Edison Mitofsky, the company that performed the exit polls in the U.S., also provided exit polls for the Ukraine and got nearly the same skewed results. The public reaction in both countries proved quite different. However, the American public is worried enough to support legislation. There are several bills that attempt to protect the public from e-voting fraud. On the state level, Senate Bill 1683, which passed the Senate unanimously, makes audit trails the legal ballot in a recount. It also requires the DRE manufacturers to make the source code public. On the national level, a bill introduced by Rush Holt, H.R. 550, would, among many things, require paper audit trails for all DREs nationwide. Dan Johnson Weinberger, director of the Midwest Democracy Center, spoke last and did not use the microphone. He focused on possible action steps to avoid e-voting fraud.
I am a lobbyist. I work for, progressive clients like the High Speed Rail Association and Illinois Families for Midwifery. And I encourage you guys, this is my pitch now, to think of yourselves as lobbyists. And I'm not going to talk about any of the policy stuff that everybody else knows a lot more about than I do, but I think what I'm going to talk about for a moment is what you might do now that you've heard about this. You understand there's a significant problem. We've got a very progressive election official, but isn't, you know, doing exactly what we might want. And we have a state bill moving through the state legislature, which we like a lot, but, you know, it's in the House Executive Committee now, has some problems. What do you do now? And, consistent with that really nice introduction, which I appreciate you making on sort of my philosophy on politics, it's now our challenge and our job is to figure out how to take a step forward every month instead of understanding and analyzing it and knowing that there's a problem but not really taking a step of being aware of the problems. And we're fortunate to be in the capital of Blue America in Cook County. Now, we've got a government that we're part of the governing coalition. And I think that's how we need to think of ourselves as we're not protesting anything here, but we're really part of the governing coalition. We don't get our way most of the time, and we share the coalition with the machine, and they don't always agree with us. But on a lot of things, they do. So here's some of the things that I think we ought to be thinking about. Number one is, in May, go to Springfield. You know, you've had a tremendous amount of work done with a bill that had two amendments, got out of the Senate unanimously. You got a sponsor in Julie Hamos. I saw Robin Kelly picked it up too. And now it's in the House Executive Committee. well, that needs some help. Well, that needs a push. And, you know, nobody from Oak Park is a co-sponsor yet. So go to their district office, but go to Springfield. You know, it's a lot easier to get to them. You know, if you can't take a Wednesday off, I noticed, you know, some people might be a bit on the senior side. You know, so you might have a bit more free time. You know, I'm amazed at how much more access you have in the halls of the Capitol than if you try to make a phone call or send a letter in which, you know, some 22-year-old gets the letter and puts it in a file somewhere. You know, so I would really encourage you, you know what you want, and I think about it's precisely identified in that Senate bill that's in the House now, that's passed the Senate unanimously, that we've got 3 weeks to pass it, that would make Illinois the best state in the country, is what I understand. Well, this is the time. Let's demand that the bill go through and show up and use the vehicle that Kevin was so kind to put in so much work to move forward and move where we are part of the government, you know? And the federal government, hey, we don't run things, you know? We're not going to for a long time. So I think the Hope bill is a great idea, but if I had to put my money on which one's more likely to pass, I'd say it's a state bill in Illinois. What else can you do in Illinois? Well, why don't we pass a resolution saying we ought to pass the Hope bill? You know, I understand there's only 4 of the 10 Democrats have signed on as a co-sponsor. Well, that's unacceptable, right? Well, that's part of our engaging with the people that we expect to listen to us to get on that bill. Maybe we ought to pass a resolution. Maybe the Oak Park Village Board ought to pass a resolution in favor of the Hope bill. Maybe Oak Park ought to run its own elections. Maybe Oak Park ought to just say, you know what, we appreciate all the good work that David Zorg doing, but we want to be the only jurisdiction in the world to have a publicly owned, open source voting system. That's legal. Just takes imagination, and then you guys would have to pay for it. Right? But if that's what we want, well, you know, it's not going to happen from D.C. And it's hard to happen from Springfield, but you run Oak Park, you know? So everything that you want, think of yourselves as the people who run things, to a large degree locally, to a small degree federally. So whatever you think we ought to be doing, should we run an exit poll that the big media doesn't run, but instead the university consortiums run? If we should, let's do it in March 2006 for the Illinois primary and have the data be open source and not just tell General Electric and Disney and Westinghouse, who own those networks, please, please, please release the data next time. But let's build our own infrastructure, right? You know, we are the capital of Blue America, and we have to start acting that way. And this issue is one that is sort of, especially by establishment Democrats in D.C., poo-pooed, ridiculous, conspiracy, why even bother engaging with it? Well, forget about D.C. then. You know, we don't need that culture of sort of dismissive disdain of people that want an honest count. So I guess the last two things I would say would be, finally, you know, I think, you know, I'm a huge fan of David Orr. I think he's the most progressive election official in the state. But, you know, not doing exactly everything that we want. Well, we have a county commissioner who can ultimately decide what voting equipment we're going to buy. You know, the city council, anybody from Chicago besides me? Right? Okay, we got aldermen, because they're going to make a decision too. So it's ultimately the city council, it's ultimately the county board that's going to appropriate the money to buy this equipment. And if we want to say, well, we know we did the RFP process, but we think as, you know, Commissioner Quigley or, I don't know even, who's the commissioner out here? Cook County
Collins.
All right. She's accessible, you know? I mean, that's where I think we need to be thinking about where to go, to our aldermen, to our village trustees, and we have the policy expertise. Our job is to translate that into something that our village board or our library board or our county board can actually do. And if we don't do that, how are they going to, right? It's really our burden to translate these critiques of what is happening nationally and federally into the alternative that is implemented and up and running so that in 2008, when they try to steal it in whatever the swing states are, we can say it's not some crazy idea to have open source equipment. It's running in Oak Park, or it's up and running in Cook County. But we got work to do, and so we have to think of ourselves, and this is my last point, is it's a lot of it is cultural, you know? We often tend to think of ourselves as protesting, you know, pointing out and critiquing. Well, you know, not good enough. What we need is to govern. and we are part of the governing coalition of some places, right? The final cultural thing is, I think it is exceptionally valued to continually remind people that the people who have lied to us about invading Iraq and the people that have lied to us about the cost of the Medicare drug prescription and fired people for trying to tell the truth, and the people who are lying to us now about the lack of any solution to the Social Security privatization, would lie to us about the elections which perpetuate their authority. And it is reasonable and part of a long American tradition of not trusting authority to continue to say that up front. So that when they say, well, you're just crazy conspiracy people, you know, it's crazy to think that we should trust the people who continually lie to us, right?
That was Dan Johnson Weinberger, director of the Midwest Democracy Center. Since the forum, Senate Bill 1683 in the Illinois legislature has been absorbed by another larger bill, 1968. The provisions about making the source code public and making the audit trail the legal ballot have been dropped in this bill, but it does guarantee that the audit trail will be legible. Kevin McDermott, one of the directors of the Oak Park Coalition for Truth and Justice that organized the forum on voting, says he is satisfied with the Cook County Clerk's choice of e-voting machines.
I feel that Sequoia is actually a pretty good system in terms of the kinds of reservations I have about the technology. I think they've done a very good job of addressing a lot of the security concerns that I had and I think a lot of the voting activist community has. And in particular, they are owned by a company based in Boca Raton, Florida, called Smartmatic, and that's a purchase that was just made earlier this year. And Smartmatic is the company that ran the recall election for President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Now, as you may know, the elites in Venezuela, the military, the business elite, the oil industry, they all wanted Chavez gone. But the election showed that the people wanted Chavez to stay. So he succeeded in the recall election. I think the final number is like 58 to 42 or thereabouts. So these guys at Smartmatic, the company that owns Sequoia, they ran that election with their equipment. Furthermore, Smartmatic is a company that started out as a security systems vendor. So their entire thrust, their reason for being, is to create secure systems and secure technology. So going back to the Venezuela election, that election was vetted by the Organization of American States, and the Carter Center went down and took a look at it and gave it a clean bill of health. So this company, Smartmatic, ran an election for an incumbent who was opposed by all of the powerful elites whom the voting activist community most fears in this country, you know, the oil industry, the military, the right wing, the business elite. And yet, the popular candidate won in the face of that kind of opposition on an election system created and managed by these guys at Smartmatic. And that election was later vetted by the Carter Center and Avi Rubin and other people. So my sense is that these are good guys. They know what a secure election and a fair election has to be. And they are the new owner of Sequoia. That gives me a very warm and fuzzy feeling. Now, I don't mean to be too Pollyanna-ish about it, but I think that this kind of backing is very important. And I myself did a security analysis of the four vendors that the county clerk was looking at. And I felt at the end of that analysis that Sequoia, it really had the edge anyway. So I'm pretty comfortable with the choice. I think that the clerk's office did a really good job of due diligence. And the end result is one that I think is going to work well for Cook County.
Kevin McDermott of the Oak Park Coalition for Truth and Justice. There's more information at their website on this issue. Go to opctj.org. From the Trenches is produced by Chicago's Independent Media Center. You can post your own stories, listen to this program again, or find links to news and upcoming events in Chicago and around the world through our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Thanks to WLUW for their continued support. Listen again on the last Monday in June for another report from the Trenches.